Accession number 23787, rail 6.
Major Dillon, Rail 6. We're talking about Sergeant Wilmot and the sort of wireless part of it.
Yes.
What sort of wireless procedure did you have, and what sort of wireless as well, actually?
There were suitcase sets called B2 or B set. They were crystal controlled, so you each had to have the same crystal at each end. And once you plugged it in, it was tuned. It was a sort of, you didn't have to twiddle knobs. It was tuned. The only knob you had to twiddle was the on off and the volume. It had a directional aerial, which had to be the right length and face the right direction to get the range. It was all on key, no speech, all on Morse. And the range was considerable to Cairo, but you got straight through. And these sets were all, they were known as suitcase sets, they were in suitcases. And I remember taking a set down to Athens once, this is much later on. My Greek runner said, we had a black market truck.
So
confusing.
So, was there any special procedure when you went online?
You had twice daily what they call schedules. At a certain time of the day, you came up, irrespective, either no traffic or here comes a message. In the same way, Cairo would come up and transmit a message if they had one. But you established communication twice a day.
And if you didn't establish, that would be a serious thing if you didn't get
through? It often happened. Something, the Germans might have come, something might have happened. They weren't unduly perturbed immediately.
And what about when you were on? You had to be quick because... was there also a fear of sort of directional radio finding?
Up in the mountains, not really, because the distance was too great but in the town later on in Athens, of course, you had to be very careful because they had these vans going around the streets. And
so that was, you had the wireless, you had a Greek interpreter, just one.
And while still on the wireless, it was driven by a 12-volt accumulator, which you had to charge. That was a bit of an Achilles heel, the charging of batteries. You had a petrol engine which was noisy. Sometimes this broke down. Sometimes, you know what car batteries are like. And then we had, which was a very good punishment system, a thing like a bicycle that drove a dynamo. You sat on it and pedaled like mad to charge the battery. So if you had a prisoner of war, he was sentenced to bicycling. Bzzz, you know, like that. But by and large, they call the army chore horse, a little two-stroke engine, tuk 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 tuk. There again, that's all right in the mountains because you can't hear it. But in the town, you had to use your batteries and you had to recharge them with a battery charger off the mains. And the Germans used to come around and check your electricity meter, and if it was suddenly going up, it. So there were all sorts of wrinkles you had to find out. And again, in the town, it's very difficult to string your aerial up.
Now, what about your interpreter? You had just one interpreter?
At this stage, I hadn't got an interpreter. Jeff had this chap, Panayotis, I forget his surname. He was fluent English speaker with an American accent. He was a language teacher at Athens University. Great chap. And there was a whole corps of interpreters. I don't know who was responsible for finding them, but they were the loyalest, greatest chaps ever, these young Greek men, most at university, either students or graduates, bilingual, who immediately volunteered to come up. And, of course, they were essential because none of us spoke Greek.
Did they also teach you Greek?
No. They ain't got time. Oh, the interpreter, yes. Oh, yes, we picked up Greek. You know, having been there for a bit, I can speak quite good Greek now.
Did you make a real effort? I mean, did you realise it was important? Or?
No, I was pretty idle. You didn't really have much time. Your interpreters were so good, actually.
There'd be no question of being able to pass for Greek.
No.
Anyway, would they?
Great, great mistake, try and pass for Greek. We had some SOE officers, which should better be nameless, who thought they knew. They were classical scholars, and they spoke ancient Greek. And I remember one chap, I don't know if this is the right time to say, but in Athens, in civilian clothes, he insisted on wearing a Harris tweed jacket, because I said, Greeks don't wear Harris tweed jackets. Buy a black market suit, you know, that sort of thing. And he'd go up to a Greek policeman and say, Sas parkalo, ti ora ine, and the Greek, for God's sake, shut up, you want to know what the time is, ask me. And the policeman would scratch his head and said, come again, mate, what are you saying? Trouble with you Greeks is you don't know your own language. Well, it's like somebody who speaks Chaucer's English going up to a policeman asking what the time of day is. But anyway, that's by the way.
Now, what, so that's, who was with you, you know, the you had...
I'm now with Jeff on Mount Giona, which is towards Athens. I never actually reached, because Don's not gone. You know, he had this operation and gone.
Now, what was it, where were you staying on Mount Giona? I mean, was it in a Greek village?
At that time, it was in the open. We then went in, sometimes we're in a village, sometimes in the open, largely in the open.
And was it always in the Mount Giona area?
At that time, that was Jeff's base.
Now, what can you describe some of the operations that you engaged in with him?
For this deception business, we blew the Stelo Bridge. There's a main east-west road, which I think the book tells you, and I helped Jeff blow this bridge, which was never repaired, I'm glad to say. They never managed to repair it.
Now, tell me exactly how the operation went.
We did a reconnaissance. It was guarded by some Italians. We persuaded some of the partisans to come with us. I think the Italians had got to know about the fact that we were coming, and they were frightened. By the time we got there, they'd pushed off, so it wasn't very difficult. The partisans made a roadblock each side of the bridge to stop anybody coming. We had about a dozen mules, I think, loaded with explosives, and Jeff and I laid this across them. Took us about half an hour to lay out the charges.
Do you remember how you did that? I mean, what was the principle of
It was what they call a pressure charge. You lay the explosives against what you want to blow, like actually the surface of the bridge right across the middle and at the sides. Cover it with sandbags, and boing, down it goes. And we...
Now, where did the explosives come from?
They'd come from Cairo. They'd been dropped, and we carried them on mules. And neither of us being engineers, I think we used at least 10 times more explosives than we needed. It was the biggest bloody bang you've ever heard. And down went the bridge. So that was successful. And I gather the Italians were having a guest night, and I think they knew something was going to happen. And the Italian colonel said, they've done it, they've blown the bridge, I think we can all go to bed now. The Germans were furious. They came the next day, they threatened to shoot the Italians, they created absolute mayhem. They were very, very angry indeed. And then another thing we did was ambush a truck to get a prisoner.
And I made that. How would you plan that?
I made a bit of a cock of it. Being the infantry soldier, they said I'd be the chap to man the Sten gun, you see. So again, we put roadblock each side, hidden, to signal that a truck was coming. And various trucks came. What we wanted was a single truck. We didn't want a whole column. Jeff was on one side of the road with a rifle, and I was on the other side of the road with a Sten gun. And this single truck came along. Jeff put a shot through the windscreen, and it stopped. I went to spray the near side of the lorry with a Sten gun, and it jammed. Jeff fired another shot. A body I thought was dead fell out of the cab. In the meantime, the truck drove on. I managed to reload the Sten gun. I fired a magazine into the back of it, but it disappeared around the corner. Then there was the biggest bloody German in the world, the other side of the bush. My Sten gun was empty. The only time in my life I've ever pulled my pistol out. And he put his camarade. And we got our prisoner. On cross-examining, he confirmed that they were expecting an invasion. They'd all been warned that they might be ambushed and all this kind of thing. And we said he was very worried that he'd been taken prisoner by the Greeks. We said, no, British. He said, oh, well, I won't get my throat cut. We said, unlikely. We can send word to your next of kin and all that by radio. Have you any problems? Any, you know, being very fatherly. He was only a private soldier. Yes, I have a big problem. What about my needles? What do you mean needles? I have the syphilis. We said, I think we arranged needles for him, and he became a sort of camp follower. We used him to wind the gramophone up and fetch water and make fire and do things. And he was quite a harmless chap. He didn't know anything.
Was he German or Czech German?
He was a Czech. We call him, I suppose, I don't know what he was. He was a Czech anyway, in the German army.
And what was the purpose of taking a prisoner? Did you see
what to identify his unit. To find out, you know, they had reinforced, who had what units had come, what were they, armoured division, infantry divisions, and so on. We did it partly by, like that, taking a prisoner, and partly by observation. And one way of observing was to give a small boy some chocolates and say, when you go around the marketplace and you see a German tank, because the German soldiers were quite good with children, please tell us how many wheels it's got and how many, what number it's got on its side and that sort of thing. That was a very good way of finding out. And by that means, we sent all this to Cairo, and we had an identification book, German units, you know. You could page a number, such and such on the tank, indicates it belongs to such and such a division and all that sort of thing. So we built up a picture of what reinforcements had come into the country, which was fed from different sources, and somewhere back in Cairo was collated, and they got the picture, as it were.
And what other operations do you remember about this time? I mean, that's part of animals. What other raids did you make?
We did some mines on the road, and that's about all, actually, because then that was the end of animals.
What about the laying of mines on roads? What were the...
Well, I tell you what we did. Not so much mines. It was stuff called exploding mule shit. And do you know who was in charge of deception? I did have a quick briefing from him in Cairo. Do you remember in your childhood Masculine Duvant the Conjurers? Does it ring a bell? They were famous pre-war. Captain Masculine was in charge of deception. He was the world's leading conjurer. And one of the things was exploding mule shit. And exploding mule shit consists of a plastic explosive which you can mold like putty with some glue on it and dried mule shit sticking to it and a detonator which you stuff in. And you just chuck it down the road. And the easiest way to do it was to find some old woman going to market and say, here you are, my dear, here's a dozen. Just drop these on your way up the road. They weren't terribly powerful. They would blow the wheel off a truck. But they irritated the Germans. And what was good to see, the Germans twigged what was going on. What was good to see on the road were fatigue parties of German soldiers sweeping the roads, sweeping the shit off because they were covered in mule shit. So that we did a bit of that.
Anything else?
No, that was about it.
What about the partisans? We haven't talked much about them.
Were
they ELAS partisans or guerrillas?
Well,
or
Jeff had this thing. There was the Psaros, the right wing party, which the ELAS, they eventually murdered him. Jeff had these. What do they call them? The 42nd Regiment. They were democratic partisans with this Colonel Psaros, who was a regular Greek officer, which we supported and supplied. But eventually he was overcome by the ELAS and they murdered him. So after that, in that part of Greece, there was only ELAS left.
Were they called Psaros?
They were called, it was a code name. Psaros is Greek for fish. I forget what his proper name was. And it was very sad, really, but it's happened.
And what did you think of the two? I mean, did you have an opinion about the Psaros or the ELAS partisans?
It was very. One tried to stand back and not and not take sides. Well, I always say, well, it's their bloody country if they want to cut each other's throats. The extraordinary thing is, whatever, however much they hated each other, one band of partisans and the other, you as a British officer were utterly safe either way. Neither of them would ever give you away to the Germans. But to try and create cooperation between the two, because the main right-wing party was Edes up in the northwest of the country, which was a considerable force, were always fighting each other, more so than fighting the Germans. And we used to try and referee, but without much avail. And that's the tragic story of Greece, really, is politics.
And so what happened next then? How many weeks did these animals operations go on for?
Oh, about a fortnight, I think. Not very long.
And what happened next? I mean,
we then sort of revert. The next thing had happened, a signal came that I was to proceed from Giona.
How do you spell Giona, by the way?
G-I-O-N-A. G-I-O-N-A. To Don Stott's old area. We hadn't really known what had happened to Don other than the fact he'd gone, because there'd been a drop there and I was to take over the area. Don Stott was definitely not coming back, the signal said. So we really didn't know what had happened to him at that stage. I was to go and take over, and I marched in a hurry, I was told to go. Very important.
Which area? Was it the Mount Helicon?
Mount Helicon.
And that's
became my stamping ground from then on.
And that was 60 miles west of Athens?
Yes, and it was about 98 miles from where I was on Giona. And I marched night and day to get
there. Who was going with you? Who went with you?
At that stage, I had nobody with me, only a Greek guide, a mule driver.
And what happened on the journey?
Nothing other than very, very, very sore feet. And the pony I had, it never recovered. I rode part of the way and walked part of the way. Finished the horse off. But I got there, and there was Charlie Much, and then there appeared from Athens.
So who's Charlie Much? Sorry.
The New Zealand sergeant, who'd been on the Asipos bridge raid and then had joined Don Stott. And he then told us what had happened to Don Stott. And he'd been left behind there, wondering what was going to happen next. I was what happened next. And also what happened next appeared Don Stott's interpreter, who became my interpreter, George Astras. Thank God, who'd come back up from Athens and told us what had happened to Don, because he'd helped get him into the clinic.
And so you had this, you had it's the same sort of setup as the previous one,
yes.
Gordon Creed had.
I now had to get that going. And
how did you set about getting it going?
Well, it sort of grew. Don started left quite a residue of agents on the airfields and some agents on the railway, which we reinforced and kept going. So we had continuous information about railway traffic. And hopefully we were going to try and blow up trains in the locomotive sheds. We did succeed in doing a few later on, but nothing very successful.
So
I discovered why I'd been sent down there in a hurry. It wasn't just to take over from Don Stott, who'd been pulled out to Cairo. It's because in error, 10,000 gold sovereigns had been dropped on his own dropping zone. The reason being that the pilot his original target had been the headquarters, the SOE headquarters in the north of the country. When he got there, he'd been signaled not to try and drop because there were Germans about. So he'd moved to a secondary area where there were no signal fires lit. And he said, well, I remember once upon a time, Mount Helicon, there used to be a DZ. I wonder if there's anybody alive down there. So when he got there, a lot of fires suddenly got lit because the shepherds, if they heard a British plane, used to light fast because they never knew what might come down. And so he said, well, I better not take this lot back to Athens. The pilot didn't know what he was dropping. No point in taking a bloody lot back. There seems to be somebody down there. I drop it there. So when he got back to Cairo, they said, where did you drop them? Where did you do your drop? And he said, oh, Pelican. They said, what? There's nobody there. He said, well, there were a lot of fires alight. So it was panic because they knew there was all this money. So that's why I was sent galloping down.
And what had happened?
And Charlie, well, Charlie much realized what it was. These containers were they knew that he knew they were money containers. It was rather like cowboys, didn't it? He was sitting on the container smoking a pipe, and they were sort of circling around him, rather like Indians. Because the Greeks bloody well knew too. They had a pretty shrewd idea.
What was Charlie Much like? He was your radio, your sergeant?
No, he was a New Zealand sergeant who did an escape prisoner.
Sorry. What was he like?
Very tough. Real New Zealand soldier. He'd been on the Aspos Bridge raid as well. And he'd survived, what, 2 winters by now, as a prisoner on his own in the mountains, escaped. And he said one of the things, I don't know whether this is one dares put down in the tape, but you scrap it out if you like. You suffer from constipation when you've got nothing to eat except berries and roots. And he said, you know you've got constipation when you can't shit properly. And he said, but you know there's something there and you dig it out with a stick. However, he was that sort of chap. He was very tough.
Which radio operator did you have with you? Who's your wireless sergeant?
I then got Don Stott's radio and operator, who had been sheltering in the village. He appeared.
That would be Jim Spencer, would
it? Jim Spencer, who'd been with Don Stott. So I was now established on...
What was he like? You know,
he was, a regular soldier, very good. He sadly got a bit funny towards the end. He'd been there a long time and started causing trouble with the LS, going around having fights and getting drunk in the village. I thought, what the hell am I going to do? I don't know how to work this thing myself. And that's when Jim Armand,
we'll come to that, yeah.
Appeared and saved the day.
So I'm now
set up. I've got an interpreter, Georgia Strauss, and a radio operator.
I should have asked, what happened to the money? I mean, did you get it out again? Or
we loaded it up on mules. I got an escort, you know, with an LS officer and made him sign for it and the whole thing. It was correctly escorted up to our headquarters and not stolen.
Now, what about your interpreter, George Astros?
George Astros now appeared.
What was he?
He was half English. He was an accountant with the Saucony Vacuum Petrol Company in Piraeus, whose boss, funnily enough, was one of Miriam's sort of sugar. It was not a godfather, sort of godfather figure. We didn't know at the time. And he was completely bilingual, but very well known in Athens. How do you persuade the Germans that you're no longer about? You die. How do you die? He was still working for Saucony Vacuum, you see, apparently. You go to the Germans and ask for leave to go and visit a sick uncle on one of the islands. You then get hold of the local newspaper, who publishes the shipping timings every day in the paper. The Kaiki Ayas Yorgis leaving for Ithra, whatever the island was, 6 o'clock on Tuesday night. They publish these times. And he says, that's the boat I want to catch. And the Germans say, yes, you can have 48 hours leave. He goes off. The same newspaper the next day publishes an article. We regret to report that the Kaiki Ayas Yorgis was caught in a storm and sank with all hands. The following remarks, then to be lost, George Astras, drowned. So he's gone, isn't he? So what does his widow do? Puts on her widow's weeds, goes down to the German office, Saucony Vacuum office in Piraeus, and for the rest of the war drew George Astras' Saucony Vacuum pension. So he was really dead. I mean, well, people say that looks just like George Astras, but it can't be because he's dead. So I've got him now.
And the other one you had with you was a Pole, Henrik Biernerki.
Oh, quite a lot of Poles. Again appeared and was attached to me a chap called Adam Kula, who was a Polish officer, part of SOE. And his mission was to persuade Poles to desert from the German army. There were a lot of Poles in the German army. When Poland was overrun by the Germans, the prisoners were offered two alternatives. So military prisoners, you could go and work in a factory in Germany, or join the German army, but fight on the Russian front. Well, the Poles hated the Russians, so they didn't mind doing that. And what happened to a German division after it had been on the Russian front for some time? They used to be sent to the Balkans or Greece for a so-called rest. Adam Kula's task was, he could pass as a German, he'd dress up as a German, go down to the transit camp, meet Polish soldiers, introduce himself and say, out, I want you out. And he collected a lot like this. He said, I don't need you, just you. You each bring two automatic weapons with you. He had all these people coming up the mountain. Very brave man, Kula. And one was Henrik Bernacki, who became my groom and escort, great chap, who I kept in touch with him right after the war, got him a job in England on a farm.
Now, other people... The main part of your thing was Elas.
Yeah,
is that right?
Elas, yes.
What was your relationship with the Elas part?
On the whole, it varied. Some of them were perfectly all right. The Elas officers, you know how the communist thing works. You have a military commander, and the Greeks call him a capitanis, a commissar. The commissar, in fact, really had more ultimate authority than the military commander. The military commander was supposed to command the battle, but the capitanius, the commissar, had the power of life and death. He was the political head. That's how they ran the thing. And I always used to get on pretty well with the Elas officers and such. A lot of them were ex-Greek army officers who were perfectly right, but these commissars were communists, of course, who more or less ran the thing, and that's where we had the trouble.
And were they close by you, or where were the Elas as opposed to yourselves?
They used to move about in quite considerable bands, quite considerable numbers.
Now, in this book, there's a reference to that the Elas were also deceived by Operation Animals.
Yes.
Deception. Can you talk about that a bit?
At the time of Animals. We all thought, never mind the Greeks, that the invasion was coming. In fact, I was told on being briefed, you won't be there very long, old boy, you know. In fact, I stayed there for 18 months. I thought I was there for a couple of months. Because we were definitely deceived, as much as anybody else, that we were the preliminary to an invasion. The Elas thought exactly the same. So they were concentrating in my area, because it was the nearest area to Athens. They thought, well, if the invasion's coming, we want to get into Athens, don't we? So they concentrated down there in large numbers. And then the Germans realized this, so they decided to have a go. And we very nearly perished.
So what do you remember of the German attack? How did they organize it?
We were in a village called Kiriaiki.
How do you spell that? Sorry.
Kyriaki, Kiriaiki. Quite a large village, which Don had occupied and I occupied. We were in a house. We were living in...
Was that always your base?
At that time. We'd moved into this village because we thought, you know, why not? There were lots of partisans around. We thought it was reasonably safe. Unbeknownst to me, and just before I'd arrived, a Corporal Wright, who's a British ex-POW, Royal Army Medical Corps, who'd had escaped and been looked after in Athens by a Greek family, had married a Greek girl, and in fact put her in the family way, we tried to get hold of all these people, and he'd come up to the mountains, as it were, to report for duty, and had applied to Don Stott for compassionate leave to go down to Athens, and Don said, no, you know too much, you can't go.